One more little bit of music before I start the sermon. I'm going to need some help in a few places. The choir has practiced with me the little song, the chant, the words are in the order of service there. Listen, listen, listen to my heart's song, and that's repeated. Please help me sing it. Listen, my heart's song. Listen, listen, listen to my heart's song. I will never forget you. I will never forsake you. I will never forget you. I will never forsake you. Listen, listen, listen to my heart's song. Listen, listen, listen to my heart's song. I will never forget you, never forsake you, never forget you, I will never forsake you. We'll sing that more. There's a Sufi teaching story about a stream that yearned to go to the sea. This stream came to life as a tiny spring off in high hills, where it trickled down and joined other such trickles. It gurgled past rocks and rills. Sometimes it was fast and white with waves. Sometimes the stream was slow and placid. Always it headed toward the sea, following its longing, its heart song. Then one day it got to a desert. It tried to continue in its usual way, but found itself either stuck in a marsh or drying up in the hot sun, just disappearing in the sand. The stream felt stymied, stuck. What now? It was convinced that its destiny was to cross the desert and be in the ocean, but there didn't seem to be a way. Suddenly there was a hidden voice that came from the desert itself and whispered, "The wind crosses the desert, and so can a stream." Now the stream thought this was pretty strange. It was only dashing itself against the sand, wasn't it? The wind could fly, and this was why and how it could cross the desert. But how can a stream do that? Well, the desert sang back, "You must allow the wind to carry you over to your destination." "How can this be?" said the stream. The desert replied, "By allowing yourself to be absorbed into the wind." "Will I be able to hear my heart's song then?" wondered the stream. The wind told the stream that it would have to be brave because it would have to mean change. Now, the stream thought it already changed a lot already, given the way it started as a little tiny trickle, now it was a great big river. The wind said it'd have to change more this time if the stream dared to continue. That stream's heart song was strong, though, strong enough that it did take this dare. It allowed the wind to carry it over the desert, a molecule at a time. And those of us who know about modern science know that, of course, the wind hit up against the mountains and the water fell out and it did make its way to the sea. Listen, listen, listen to my heart's song. Listen, listen, listen to my heart's song. I will never forget you. I will never forsake you. I will never forget you. I will never forsake you. When my friend Joyce told me about the David Thompson Brigade canoe trip from Alberta to Thunder Bay, there was no question in my mind that I would go. I always yearned for another canoe trip, a longer canoe trip. My longest one before that had been 2 weeks for a single trip, but in 1992 I racked up 40 days in a canoe in July and August when I was guiding. This commemoration of the Canadian explorer and cartographer David Thompson started on the Mother's Day weekend and finished on July 12th. That was 64 days. I figured I could join it just after Father's Day when Beacon completes its church year. I knew I needed to go. A short while later, I told my colleagues at the Pastoral Leadership Program in Seattle. I was taken aback by how emotional I became as I explained to them just how important canoeing and being in wilderness was to me. The yearning was so palpable, I needed to listen. Listen, listen, listen to my heart song. Listen, listen, listen to my heart song. I will never forget you. I will never forsake you. I will never forget you. I will never forsake you. My heart song was shouting. I don't know why I dug out the formal letter of agreement that we signed together 5 years ago now. I was surprised to read that I was already eligible for a sabbatical. I could join that canoe trip even sooner. And of course, I did, as you know, just after the May long weekend. I could spend over 50 days paddling halfway across Canada. So what was the big deal, you ask? Why was it important? Imagine a car ride across half of Canada, one where you traveled only 50 to 75 kilometers a day. You have lots of time to look at the countryside. However, we didn't only ride in a vehicle, a converted school bus in our case. We also paddled the old voyageur route from the Pays Yano, the fur country, to the rendezvous in Fort William on Lake Superior in voyageur-sized canoes. The whole trip was more than 3,200 kilometers. I got to participate in 2,500 kilometers or so. Most days we paddled 6 to 10 hours. Some days we could trade off some people in the middle, so my first few days were only partial ones. I was happy to get in shape a little more gradually. If I wasn't paddling, I was on the ground crew, driving the bus and helping set up tents and tables and getting groceries and propane for both bus and stove, and fixing supper, or sitting around waiting for either the boats to come in or my turn to paddle. 50 to 75 kilometers in a day isn't much if you're in a vehicle, but it adds up fast in a canoe. At about 50 strokes a minute, with maybe an hour a day off for breaks, tops, that adds up to a lot of paddle strokes. The big surprise for me was the cumulative fatigue. I had figured that, well, once I get in shape, it'll be, you know, I'll work each day and then the next day I'll begin again. Well, it wasn't quite that easy. We did have one day off a week, yes, to get more groceries and do laundry if we were lucky enough to have a laundromat nearby, and quite a variety of other chores. The day off never seemed to be enough, not really a day off. Everybody was rather tired by the end of it. Oh, and did I mention the arrival ceremonies? Each time we got to a small community or a historical site like Fort Carleton or Old Fort William, we did a fancy entrance ceremony. It was a ritual. We started off with the 10 or 12 canoes paddling a figure of eight, or maybe just a circle, landing more or less carefully in front of the dignitaries. Someone, often someone with a local connection, would fire off the musket to get their attention, presumably as if they hadn't seen us arriving, and ask for permission to come ashore. Those on shore would reply with both gun and come ashore. If the locals didn't have a gun, our advance crew supplied one. It wasn't just an advance guy. It was a crew of three or four people. Then we would land and usually parade up to the place where they made the speeches of welcome and hospitality before their proffered feast. The landing might take 15 minutes. We often waited for an hour or more for the appointed time to arrive, sitting in the rain or more often the hot sun. Yes. Paddle, drive, dinner, sleep. I began to think of it as a pilgrimage, a journey of spiritual significance. It wasn't the destination. The end point of Old Fort William is not a Mecca for me. It has no particular significance. True, it is a replica of a fur trade era trading post, complete with reenactors bringing it to life. I've been there before. I've also been to Lower Fort Garry in Selkirk, Manitoba, a very similar place. The brigade stopped at numerous such forts along the way. Fort Pitt in eastern Alberta before I got it on the trip. Fort Carleton in Saskatchewan. Fort Gibraltar in Winnipeg. As well as Fort Selkirk, and must have been another one. They begin to look a bit alike. Fort William is notable for being the largest and most complete example, even if it's not on the place it used to be. That place is now a rail yard. So the end was not the point. What happened along the way was the reason for going. Being in the wilderness, paddling the waterways of Canada, was such a joy for me to be on the North Saskatchewan River again, a river I had learned to paddle on, even though I'd never paddled it in Saskatchewan before. Even as it was a joy to paddle the lakes of Manitoba, that was also scary. I am not so comfortable in big waves, although I did get a little more used to them. It was a particular joy to paddle the storied Winnipeg River with its whitewater and lakes, even though we were going upstream and the lakes are now reservoirs. Given that the river was in flood and they were spilling the dams, even the lakes had current. Although we clocked ourselves with GPS at 8 kilometers an hour going upstream on those lakes. From the Winnipeg River, we portaged into the Lake of the Woods, where even the voyageurs got lost. We had a local guide in a powerboat, and we needed him. Again, the connection to history was evident, especially once we got to the more southern, less cottaged part of the lake. The island we camped at was apparently a traditional voyageur campsite. I can't tell you how emotional I was about a week later on July 1st, Canada Day. We had slept on a tiny island right on the U.S.-Canada border in Ontario, east of Rainy Lake. It was a beautiful campsite, quintessential Canadian shield, warm, swimmable water, even if it did have some poison ivy. One tent was pitched right on the borderline. It was marked by a survey pin. The brothers Bates slept with their heads in the U.S., their feet in Canada. They couldn't have done it the other way around, or they would have rolled into the lake. In the morning, as soon as we got together, we sang O Canada, except that I was a bit choked up and couldn't sing very well. By this time, I had paddled 5 weeks, crossing the prairies and entering the boreal forest of eastern Manitoba and western Ontario. I had indeed traced one warm line through a land so wide and savage, as Stan Rogers sang it. Landscape is one of the touchstones of my life, and I was so close to it. Being in that familiar landscape of Canada was the highlight of my trip. There were other things, too. First, this was an immediate, if transient, community. People came and went. And given the focus I had had last year on leadership and the fact that I was on the canoe team with the brigade executive in it, I had a prime seat to observe some leadership styles. The brigade chief, Ted, was the guy in charge on the water. While he tried very hard not to be so, he really wanted to be dictator. Each evening, there was a meeting of all the team captains, some dozen folks, plus sometimes their deputies and other observers like myself. He struggled to get consensus on such basic things as, what time are we all going to start in the morning? Some knew that really early starts would mean paddling in much less wind. Others knew their teams just couldn't get up early enough to be on the water before 7 a.m. It did work a very few days to be on the water at 6, but not more than that. Ted wanted all 12 or 13 canoes to paddle together in one group. Well, that worked once or twice. More often, the two or three gazelles, as Ted called the fast teams, paddled together. And then there were usually two and sometimes three other clusters of canoes. One canoe was almost always late getting on the water, like an hour or more late. Never mind, they were one of the gazelles and usually finished first. They were natives from Cumberland House, and when we got to Cumberland House on the North Saskatchewan River, the end of the road, they closed a school, and they had canoe races with classes for 11-year-olds. They weren't teaching them, they were racing classes. The fast folks wouldn't wait, and the slower folks just couldn't get going and keep going much faster, even if they wanted to, which mostly they didn't. Everyone wanted to go their own pace. Running this circus took much more than a ringleader. Each team had its own internal dynamics as well. The nature and style of the team captain affected how well each team got along. And of course, what kind of history did they have as well? Had they been together? There was one team that was from a club and they were quite accustomed to doing things together in Nervo as your canoe. So they had their way of doing it. Our team did pretty well most of the time, but scratch the surface just a little bit and you'd find some disagreements that sometimes got addressed, but mostly didn't. One person did go home much earlier than planned. Other teams had their moments too, which we heard about only in little smidges. One team with at least a dozen members, so that's two paddling teams of six each, ended up with two quite separate paddling sub-teams who didn't communicate much at all. Other teams had a problematic person or two, being brigade chief and team captain for our one person on our particular team was too much. But being captain, the team captain of the Pathfinder team, with the brigade chief as one of the Indians, it didn't work either. We rotated the role of team captain among three of us, and each of us found out that we weren't really team captain. Too many chiefs, including the big one. We managed, although I had difficulty with it at the end. In retrospect, I realized I needed to understand that we really were a group of peers on our team, and the team captain was filling one role among many in the team's functioning. I found observing various leadership styles fascinating, especially when I compared it and contrasted my own rather laid-back style with others' more directive styles. We really did call ourselves the circus. You know, we'd all run away to join this circus. With what with our shows and all the accoutrements of a traveling show, each team really did have to have transport for all of their people, 6 to 12 or 14 people, and their canoe, and their gear. There were a variety of approaches. We tried, our team Pathfinder, to get along with just one vehicle, a propane-powered converted school bus. It worked well in some respects. We could climb aboard all wet and cold and at least be dry and out of the wind while we changed clothes. Our gear was accessible, not packed to the roof somewhere or underneath. It got a little messy at times, but it worked. The bus guzzled propane, though, and a couple of times resupply was more distant than we thought for. At one place, we transferred propane from small barbecue tanks into the bus tank. That takes a while. Just enough to get us to the next appropriate gas station, believe me, one that was not only open and had propane, but also had the required person to operate it. One time we got to there, well, he's not here, he's off at a ball game. Team Pathfinder later added a small car to his entourage, which made getting to school programs and getting groceries much easier. We pulled a canoe trailer for two, and occasionally it had three canoes on it. Other teams used pickup trucks, station wagons, rented vans, fifth-wheel trailers, you name it. One team brought along Mom to be the team cook. Another team brought a hot tub with propane bottles to heat it up. And so occasionally you'd see the fire department truck coming to fill up their canoe, the hot tub. Actually, those two examples came from the same team. I guess I was on the wrong team. All in all, the number of vehicles and trailers was amazing. We were something like 100 or 130 people at any one time. We were an instant community. Except that it wasn't terribly connected. Many teams had individuals who were strangers until they showed up for the brigade. I was no exception. I had met one couple on my team maybe 25 years ago, and most of the rest of them for one evening in January. I really didn't know any of them. I did know one other person, Joyce, my friend. She paddled with us for 3 weeks. So mostly our connections were shallow and short-lived. By the end, though, of course, we had become more than acquaintances, but the demands of journey had made us friends of a particular kind. What do we have in common beyond a certain fanaticism for paddling? Not sure. Little of that was discovered. Although I will reconnect with two of my team, Ted and Louise, his wife, are joining the build in Honduras in February. This experience and a particular kind of community brings me back to what I've learned before. I need community, a place where I belong and where I have a place in it. I need to have roots and a context where people know me well enough that I can do stupid things occasionally and be forgiven if it's not too egregious. I need to belong to a group where I know there are some commonalities, some assumptions, so I don't need to tread too carefully all the time. It helps when conditions allow for relaxation and restful conversation, which was not common on the brigade. I also learned, again, that I have to find a way to keep paddling. Like the stream yearning for the sea, though, I need to change how I do that for a number of reasons. Now I paddle. This month I've been paddling with the Fort Langley Canoe Club once or twice a week in an outrigger canoe. I'd never seen one until a month ago. A week after I got home, though, I joined the Fort Langley Canoe Club's reenactment of Simon Fraser's 1808 journey to the sea on the Fraser River. I'd missed the bit from Fort St. John to Quesnel. I hadn't heard about it soon enough. But I joined them in hope and paddled to Vanier Park, where we did the ritual arrival ceremony. I'm trying to listen. Listen, listen, listen to my heart song. Listen, listen, listen to my heart song. I will never forget you. I will never forsake you. Never forget you. I will never forsake you. Listen, listen, listen to my heart song. Listen, listen, listen to my heart song. I will never forget you. I will never forsake you. I will never forget you. I will never forsake you.